Welcome to the Readings Podcast, a production from Melbourne's leading independent bookstore, Readings. In today's episode, another installment of The Comics Question, a series where Bernard Callio and I discuss comics, graphic novels, and all manner of illustrated books, zines, and other associated productions. In this episode, Bernard was joined by Readings bookseller Nick Curnow to give a roundup of some of the most intriguing, beautiful, and thought-provoking comics and graphic novels from 2023. This is part one of two, so do subscribe to be notified when the second installment of this particular conversation is made available. Here's Bernard to introduce.
Welcome to the Readings Podcast and to the corner of the Readings Podcast known as The Comics Question. I'm Bernard Callio. I sell books at Readings in Carlton, and we've done some interviews on The Comics Question with comics creators, but today, something a little bit different. Today I'm talking with my colleague Nick Curnow. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how's it going?
Very, very good. Today we're going to, in this episode of the
two-part spectacular.
Thank you, Nick. Yes. We're going to continue the conversation that we engage in when we're working together, and that's a lot of it is talking about comics. Talking about comics, about the creators, about the publishers, and even a bit about comics criticism. Well, how we thought we'd structure this is to do a sort of a back and forth discussion about notable books, notable comic books, and by that we kind of mean graphic novels published in 2023. Each go back and forth talking about books.
Yeah.
Interject, I'm sure, as is our wont.
Mm.
But of course, we are recording in Naarm, Melbourne, on the lands of the Wurundjeri people, and we pay our respects to elders past, present, and future. Nick, before we actually start talking about books, I wanted to ask you, what's your comics origin story? You know, Peter Parker got bitten by a spider, and how did you start in comics?
I had sort of a late start to comics. Uh-huh. I didn't start reading comics until I was about in high school. I went to a school in Scotland, and occasionally we'd be let out, go for a day trip to the nearest town, which was Inverness. And there was like a little comic shop in Inverness that I'd go to.
Yep.
And at that stage, I was like really upset. I wasn't really like, I've never been a big fan of like superhero comics. I think I got put off them like when I was growing up in the 90s, just because they were so ugly, printed on cheap newspaper. Yeah, so at this place in Inverness, I think they're closed down now, I discovered like Hellboy and BPRD. And that was sort of like my gateway drug into like independent comics.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the universe of Hellboy and
think the thing that really drew me in, because I've always loved like mythology and like folk tales and things. I think there was like a real, because a lot of the stories were like drawn from folk tales, that was a really big draw.
Yeah.
And I think as well the art style, because I am a practicing artist as well, but I've always been interested in the arts.
Yep.
And so, like, how beautifully drawn those Hellboy comics are.
Talk to us about
chiaroscuro.
Yes.
Like, yep. The beautiful blacks, the pacing of his comics. They'd be just like, you know, two characters talking. But, like, the entire sequence would take place, like, looking over, like, a series of sculptures in an empty room. And that was really exciting and, like, really beautiful. And then, like, you contrast that with, like, at that time, like, BPRD was being drawn by Guy Davis. His drawings just have such life and bounce to them.
And like, so these are both BPRD, which is the Bureau of
Paranormal Research and Defence.
Thank you. both written by Mike Mignola, the creator behind Hellboy.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's quite a universe now, that Hellboy universe.
Yeah, yes. It really expanded. And I sort of dropped off after Guy Davis sort of, like, left doing BPRD, I sort of lost interest because the drawings, I love the drawings. Like, I'm a simple creature. I like a really nicely drawn thing. And then eventually, like, the main Hellboy series wrapped up as well with I think it was like 2013, 2014 was like the death of Hellboy arc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I sort of, at that time as well, I ended up discovering like independent comics, like Al Columbia, Josh Simmons, a lot of European things.
Yes. Look, Hellboy is a very interesting gateway drug because it's not being published by the big two. It's being published by a smaller publisher, Dark Horse Comics.
Yeah.
Still quite a large player, but certainly not those Marvel or DC who are really known for their superhero comics.
Yeah.
Dark Horse is a bit more experimental, but then what you're talking about with Al Columbia and even more, I suppose, underground comic book artists. Hellboy is still genre.
Yeah.
You know, he's still a big hell.
Oh yeah, it's Hellboy is essentially quote unquote a superhero comic.
Mm.
It's got that sort of like the arc of a superhero comic. However, because it was an individual person that was sort of dividing how the story would go, the art, who would do the art,
yes.
How that would go.
So it's a vision, really.
It's a vision,
yeah,
exactly. And so you end up not with that sort of like the corporatized mechanism of a superhero comic where it would be like Peter Parker gets bitten by a spider at the beginning and then like five issues later, we're going to like do the same story, but like somebody else is writing it and there's like a slightly different telling of the tale.
And that, folks, is why you're not going to be listening to Nick and I talking about superhero comics in a nutshell. But we're actually going to talk about individual comics that came out last year that we think were notable for one reason or another. I'm going to lead off, and I'm going to speak mostly about Australian comics because that's my bent. I've been part of the Australian comics making community for longer than Nick's been alive. that's where my allegiances, I suppose, lie. But we'll both talk about comics that caught our eye in 2023. The first I want to speak about is Bulk Nuts by the Melbourne comic book creator Mandy Ord. This book is published by Gazebo Books, which is a publisher from up in Sydney who also publish poetry and literary fiction, I suppose. So one of the things that I'm really keen for me and Nick to talk about in this discussion is about the provenance of comics, where they come from, and that means not just the creators, but you know, who's a publisher? Why is this being read? Those sort of questions. And Gazebo is publishing this Mandy Ord book because their designer, Phil Day, is an old friend of Mandy Ord's from art school days. Anyway, Bulk Nuts, which is a pretty funny title, is descriptive, though, because in this collection, quite a sizable collection, 255 pages, sort of a square format, paperback, but with lots of nuts on the cover.
You'd be nuts to miss it.
And there you are, ladies and gentlemen, and others.
We've made it 5 minutes in and there's a nut pun.
So Mandy's work is invariably autobiographical. She has this persona, this avatar that she draws herself in, which is this big one-eyed cyclopean sort of person. Everybody else in the comic has two eyes. But what I always love about that as a conceit, I suppose, is that's what it feels like to look. It doesn't feel like you've got two eyes. It feels like you've got one eye because you only see one thing. I think it's a well-tuned way of pointing out who the character who is living this story is. It's well spelled, I suppose, visually. Anyway, Bulk Nuts is a collection of short stories by Mandy. She's done graphic novels, continuous ones, one stories across many pages, but this one is a collection of many short stories, and they are stories of her childhood, stories of encounters in the world. And she has for long-time readers of Mandy, and Mandy's been producing work now for 30 years, what you see is this evolution of her voice, the visual voice. And one of the things that all of the creators we're going to be talking about today is that they've all got really distinctive voices. Now, visual voices, comics voices. We listen with our eyes, I think, with comics.
I was going to say, like, how does the voice work with the autobiographical material?
Yeah. Okay, so I think what's happening in Bulk Nuts is that I am seeing an evolution. The most previous work that Mandy did was an autobiographical daily strip book, When One Person Dies, The Whole World Is Over, published by Brow Books 4 or 5 years ago. And that is a real torrent, I suppose, because it's just day after day after day after day. Beautifully observed. They are crafted, but they're not as crafted as the stories in Bulk Nuts.
Yeah.
In Bulk Nuts, they're really, each one has sort of been, They read almost more as poems in the sense that they're short and that we're really leaning into the emotionality of Mandy's luscious black brushwork. And so what you're getting, I think, in Bulk Nuts is more finesse in Mandy Ord's visual voice. It's a bit of a, I don't know if it's a quantum leap, but it's certainly a leap that I observe in her feel. Things are happening in these comics, but it's Mandy's very particular a visual voice that gives it, these stories, their power, their funniness, their tragedy. It's a new level for her. I'd really recommend it as a starting point to get into Mandy Ord's work. Great local cartoonist. So over to you.
Okay.
You're going to talk to about a very strangely named book.
The very strangely named book. I have the very luridly titled Blood of the Virgin by Sammy Harkham, which was published by Pantheon Press. Now, this collects 14 years of work that has been put out in various self-published formats. Sammy Harkham is a cartoonist and an editor. He does a self-published series called Crickets, which is where most of Blood of the Virgin was originally published. And he's also done an incredibly important anthology series that comes out every few years called Kramer's Ergo, which is one of the best barometers of independent comics at large. Blood of the Virgin is also the most novel-y of the comics that I'm going to be talking about.
So it's one big
It's one arc? Overarching story. Mm. And it's set in Los Angeles in 1971.
Yep.
It follows Seymour, who is a film editor and an aspiring film director, and his wife, Ida, and their young son. So Seymour has this long-standing passion to make a movie. And what he wants to do is basically make Blood of the Virgin, a Roger Corman, AIP style, horror movie.
What's AIP?
American International Pictures. Just as the star of the Hollywood machine was starting to come down from the golden age. You had a lot of these young independent producers coming up, and Roger Corman was one of those guys. And he basically kickstarted Scorsese's career, Coppola's career, Bogdanovich. If there's a big famous older person in Hollywood, Roger Corman's got his hands on him at some point.
Okay.
But Seymour is striving to find out about art. I think the core of the book is about it's the difficulty of making art and being true to your intentions for what you're making, and then the reality of the thing that's being made. That's one part of it. There's also the domestic drama between Ida and Seymour, who's wavering in his commitment to his family. The second half of the book is actually Ida's story.
Ah.
No spoiler alert here, but halfway through the book, they basically split up, and Ida returns home to New Zealand to her mother, who's a Holocaust survivor. And it delves into her past, and you get a sense of the realities of her life and the things that Seymour's visions are causing.
Mm.
But the third strand of this as well is it's a very, very beautifully rendered look at Hollywood circa 1971. But one of the best chapters in here was originally published in Kramer's Ergo 11. And it's the only full-colour chapter.
Wait a minute. So talk to us about... There's black and white stuff in this book?
It's not black and white. No. It's black and sepia. And so it's this coffee-coloured book. And that's the majority of the style. It's Do you know Frank King?
Who did
Gasoline Alley?
Yes.
So it has that sort of... His line has this sort of bouncy liveliness to it.
So Frank King, famous comic strip artist from American newspapers. What is it? 1920 to...
1920 to, I think, 60? 50s or 60s. Yeah, long time.
But beautiful, very clean line.
Oh, absolutely gorgeous. Clean line, really lush, thick forms. The daily strips are beautiful for their use of black and white.
Yes.
And then you'd have the full colour Sundays, which are
mind-blowing.
Oh, yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah. And I think that's what he's really drawing on.
Interesting.
Because you can see that difference definitely between the Seymour and Ida sections, which are told in the sepia and black and white.
Yes.
And then the one full colour chapter is done in the 12th panel Sunday strip style in full colour.
Yes. That disjunction back in the olden days of newspaper strips was a sort of a Wizard of Oz sort of thing. You know, the daily strips were black and white.
Yeah.
And then on the Sunday,
outrageous colour.
Yes.
Like the Hearst newspapers, it was a lot of people would read the papers for the funny papers on Sunday.
Indeed.
And you have people Harriman
and
Frank King and these guys who'd be putting out these huge Sunday pages as public entertainment.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of pride taken in the fact that we can get certain colours in here that you can't get at, the non-Hearst papers and things.
And certainly there's been a great, by a lot of cartoonists, a great turning back, certainly Art Spiegelman, who made Mouse, is part of this movement of looking back to those early years pre-comic books, pre-superheroes, this tradition from about 1900 into the 20th century of the comic strip in the newspaper and the way that the comic strip feeds the language of cartooning.
There's a progression and also like a technological development that sort of happens between like when newspapers were doing like the development from like, you know, pictorials in the newspaper for like your petty dreadfuls and things to like big full page like spreads to like large format like whole papers, which were just made up of the funnies.
Yes.
To like the comic book and then sort of the decline of the newspaper like comic to like just the strip. But that sort of rich period between like 1900 and like I think up to like 1940 was like with the introduction of the comic book during the war, or at least its popularization during the war, because like you needed like cheap small things to send to the troops and stuff.
Stick in the back of your pocket while you're taking pot shots at people.
Absolutely.
Take out this comic and
And
does anybody want an adolescent power fantasy? Anybody? Anybody? Anyway, sorry to go back to this beautiful hardback.
I know it is
production.
No surprises, the production's really beautiful. If you look at, like, Kramer's Ergo and any of the other comics that, like, Sammy Harkham has had, like, his hands, like, involved with, like, beautiful production design. Mm. Really gorgeous design, nicely laid out. Everything's always, like, clear and clean and crisp. He's a visionary comics artist, and it's just such a pleasure to sort of see Blood of the Virgin, like, in its full format.
And sounds like you've been following the bits and pieces of this peripatetic career of this story over the years in various little bits and pieces. Does it work as a one reading experience?
Incredibly well so. Okay. Like it's really hard to tell. Like if I told you that it was made over the course of 14 years, you'd expect like there to be like different levels and quality of the drawing. And it's amazing how consistent it is in terms of that. I think the only one that is visually different in terms of that tone is just that one full colour chapter where it's just so condensed and just like covers a life. Perfection.
Great. I mean, if comics are time and place compressed into tiny little postage stamp boxes, when it's pulled off very skillfully, it's thrilling. When time is folded and presented to us in that way. Blood of the Virgin.
Blood of the Virgin.
By Sammy Harkham.
And now what do you have?
I want to talk now about Checkpoints, which is by local creator Michael Fakaris. This is a remarkable book. So it's published by Glom Press. Glom Press is a fantastic local publisher, comics publisher, who particularly work with the technology known as a Rizzo.
The Rizzograph,
which is sort of like Gutenberg's press mashed up with a photocopier. You can put it in your back room. You put colour through it. Like, what would you call it? It's like artisanal photocopying.
Oh, yeah. It originally started off as a photocopier in Japan.
Uh-huh.
And then,
of
course, like, got brought over and it's, like, perfect for making comics.
Yeah.
It's such an amazing thing for printing comics. And Glom is definitely, like, one of the most exciting, like, small presses out there at the moment.
Indeed. I mean, you know, it seems like to talk about Sammy Harkham and Kramer's Ergo, you know, you can see the parallels between what Glom are doing with various artists. But Michael Fakaris is a comic book maker and street artist who has been working, again, for many decades. And with Checkpoints, which is about looking at his experience of having three different studio spaces in Melbourne, in different places in the city of Melbourne over the last 20 years. The technological, speaking as we were before about tech and the way that tech is always involved in comics. So, you know, so cheap photocopying meant that zine making could really come of age in the 80s and 90s. This Rizzo production means that what Glom and Michael can do is print on pages of Checkpoints on very thin paper. So you turn the page and then you can see through the page that you're reading to the page beneath that and say a panel will sort of shimmer, if you will, beneath the surface of the page you're on at the time. So you've got this sort of, I mean, literally a palimpsest, this idea that a page is not an opaque thing in this comic book. It is, as Michael Fakaris himself describes it, this is like a meditation, really, on studio spaces and what they offer to the artist. They offer this place where you can dive in, and he pictures his avatar, which is this sort of gas mask-wearing, black-suited character, actually crawling through the drawing board and into art space. He's giving, I think, a visual representation of what it is to be a maker and to be given, or to take, I suppose, really, that time and space that you need to discover what it is there. It's a sort of a poem, a visual poem, or a hymn to the beauties of that. But it also shows that, I think anyway, it shows that the trees and a natural landscape, again in this way of going underneath the page you're reading, the landscape is still there. Even though we're working with culture and this is a cultural product, but that the natural, the trees, the riverbanks of the landscape are still pulsing and still exerting their influence or their conversation on the artist. So I wouldn't call it narrative, but I would call it a dwelling. It's a dwelling. And I'm very interested in place in comics, and I think what he does here is really sacralize almost the space of the studio, but also remind us that Melbourne, this built environment, is a pretty recent sort of jerry-built thing glomped onto a old landscape, old culture. So I think it's a remarkable achievement.
It definitely is. It is a particularly beautiful book, I think. I mean, that you can't get it from like any other printing technique. It's just so gorgeously specific. I've got a weakness for like stories about artists and like people talking about like the ways that they work, and there's something beautiful about like that serious consideration of not only the work that they're producing, but like the locations and how they're producing it as well. That intense reflection that sort of comes from that is always inspiring.
Yeah, very, very excellent. So let's close off this volume one of these notable books of 2023 with a
far-off place called Okinawa.
Wonderful.
So Okinawa by Susumu Higo, and it was published last year by Fantagraphics Press, one of the great American independent comics publishers. They don't often publish manga, so that's sort of a very interesting thing.
That's really sort of, my observation is that Drawn and Quarterly do.
Drawn and Quarterly has been doing a lot of manga,
yeah.
But as well, they've also been putting out a lot more Korean. It's not called manga in Korea, there's another term for it. So it's odd that Fantagraphics would be putting out Okinawa.
Why do you think they've chosen this one?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty superlative, is probably why they've gone with it.
Okay.
I think it sort of also fits in with their general ethos. It's not very manga-y. It doesn't look manga-y. Like, the drawing is... It's almost, like, quite simplified, the drawing. It's not, like, very lush. It's gorgeous, like, pen lines, very thin line.
Mm-hmm. Not that hyper.
Everything feels kind of static, or at least slowed. Like, there's a real, like, unfolding of time, and I think that's a really big part of this book. So, Okinawa is sort of, like, it collects two of Higa's collections. The first is Sword of Sand from 1995. And that covers the period of the Battle of Okinawa, the lead up and sort of like up to when the Americans took it over.
So we're seeing the action, if you will, the actual conflict going.
Actual conflict. And then the second half is Mabui, which was originally written in around 2010. And that follows the American occupation of Okinawa and sort of like the more day-to-day lives of like the people that live in Okinawa. A lot of the thing with this book specifically as well is about like the legacy of colonialism. So Okinawa in the early 1900s was taken over by Japan. It was its own independent kingdom,
really?
The Ryukyu Kingdom. Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And so in, when was it? 1870.
Oh,
it was taken over by Japan and it was rolled into, I think it was the prefecture of Satsuma. And then eventually like it just became a fully fledged part of Japan.
Yeah.
Even though, like, Okinawa has its own distinctive language and its own cultures and things, and that's something that's brought up again and again, is this sort of friction between, in the first half, definitely, how the Okinawans, they don't want to be involved with the war, but people have been conscripted, and then the war comes to them.
Yes.
And a lot of those stories are drawn from Higa's parents' stories about, like, surviving Okinawa at that period of time. And then the second half sort of deals with, like, the legacy of not only Japanese colonialism, but also, like, American occupation.
Yes.
Because after the Battle of Okinawa and after the fall of Japan, Okinawa became, like, the site of many American military bases. And I think it was fairly recently that the Americans
pulled out
of Okinawa.
would you call it a documentary comic?
I'm not sure if I'd call it documentary. Yep. I'm not sure if I'd call it autobiographical.
Historical fiction?
Vaguely historical fiction.
Okay.
It's sort of like, maybe like lightly fictionalized autobiography.
Okay, yes,
would probably be the best thing. Because even the stories in Mabui, the second half of the book, are drawn from newspaper articles and stories of actual other people and dealing with like their interactions and sort of like how they think about things.
And is this read in the Japanese way?
It is read from right to left.
Left, yep.
And the back half of the book has like an introduction and an interview, but that's left to right.
Yes. It sounds like this book helped you to get a sense of a particular part of the world and its history.
He spends so much time focusing on like the small details of sort of like people's day-to-day lives, the small rituals that are of like the local religion, like the work that people do, like the interactions between people, how they dealt with like the American military being there or like the Japanese military occupation. But as well, like there's such like loving drawings of like the Okinawan landscape.
That's a beautiful term, loving drawings. I think that's well said. That sort of sympathy, I suppose, that a drawing can evince in terms of you can feel, is that the right word? But you get a sense of that artist leaning into the people that they're drawing and the particular qualities that people might have. You know, you get a sense of the feel of the landscape, the feel of the folks.
Absolutely, yeah. You get a definite sense of location.
Yes.
Which is always a really wonderful thing, like in a comic, when you actually get a sense of like, oh, I could be like standing right there.
Mm.
Like a real sense of like immediacy as well. It's interesting, the first half of the book, even though it's about the Battle of Okinawa, is not devoted. It's not like your typical sort of like military rah-rah fighting book. It's more concerned with civilian survival.
Yes.
Especially like during the Battle of Okinawa, which was known for its crimes against civilians.
Yes.
Was like a feat and sort of its own terrible events. It's not a very dark book, I think. It's moreover, I'd say it's more of a melancholy book.
Okay.
Melancholy bordering on hopeful.
Oh, look, you're selling me. You're totally selling me. I'm going to have to either borrow it off you or borrow it off you. One of the two.
You're more than welcome to.
Okay, so maybe we'll wrap now with this first volume of our Notable Books of 2023, and we'll be back to talk about another bunch of books. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks.
All of the books that Bernard and Nick discussed in this episode are available via all reading stores, as well as at our website, where you'll find all kinds of other recommendations for great books, music, film, and TV. You can also sign up to eNews or to receive our free monthly newsletter, The Readings Monthly. The Readings podcast is produced by me, Nick O'Callaghan. The show's music is by Tom Hoskins. This episode was recorded by Nelson Matthews. Thank you for listening.